This is Monday, May 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way, the U.S. president says there is an opening for Middle East peace.
You have a great opportunity right now. There's a great feeling for peace throughout the Middle East.
How realistic is that? We examine the issue. Also ahead, the president's former national security advisor reportedly will refuse to testify before a congressional committee. And the U.N. Security Council meets after yet another North Korean missile test. All on today's International Edition. We start with the U.S. president's first overseas journey since taking office. Donald Trump assailed Iranian aggression and military ambitions as he arrived in Israel today, his first visit to the Jewish state as the American leader.
The United States and Israel can declare with one voice that Iran must never be allowed to possess a nuclear weapon, never, ever, and must cease its deadly funding, training, and equipping of terrorists and malicious, and it must cease immediately.
The U.S. president arrived in Israel after a two-day visit to Saudi Arabia, where Trump said King Salman assured him the Saudis want peace between the Israelis and Palestinians and roadblocks imposed against Iranian threats. The U.S. president said there is a growing realization among your Arab neighbors, said that to the Israelis, that they have common cause with you in the threat posed by Iran, and it is indeed a threat. What might that opportunity be? Joining us is Natan Sachs, director and fellow of the Center for Middle East Policy at Washington's Brookings Institution. Natan, thanks for being with us. Do you think there is an opportunity here that might not have appeared in the past before?
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you. I think there is some opportunity, but we should keep our expectations very low. On the one hand, in terms of substance between Israelis and Palestinians, there's a new dimension, which is the regional one. Because of the Iranian aspect, many in the region, both Sunni Arab states and Israel, share what they see as common interests, in particular opposing Iran and opposing Iranian activity throughout the region. Now that the U.S. has sort of visibly chosen sides, and taken their side in that kind of conflict, they feel emboldened, and they also feel a commonality of interest. But for the Arab states, it's crucial for their publics that the Palestinian issue be on the table as well. And here we have a real opportunity. The Arab states can offer things to Israel that the Palestinians cannot, and Israel may feel more secure to make some concessions to the Palestinians in this regional context. But the deeper questions, the issues of Jerusalem, of refugees, of all the final status issues between Israelis and Palestinians, those are not solved simply because the context is now regional. Those remain the same. And so a grand bargain between the two sides, the ultimate deal that Donald Trump has spoken of, this, I think, still remains a very faint possibility.
Well, as you know, President Trump is scheduled to meet with Palestinian leadership on this trip tomorrow, I believe. He said in last March that a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians may not be as difficult as people have thought. He hasn't given any indication at all how he might approach the issue any differently than his predecessors.
I don't agree with him that it's not as complicated as people think. I think the contours of a final deal perhaps are known. But it's not simply for lack of brilliant negotiators that 50 years now since the 67 war, next month will be 50 years, it's not just for lack of negotiation tactics. There are deeper issues and there are disagreements between the two parties that are not going to be bridged simply by a different regional context.
The U.S. president paid a visit to the Western Wall, but he was by himself as far as officialdom was concerned. What's behind that and what does it all mean?
It's an interesting moment there. The Western Wall is the holiest site of prayer for Jews. It's just adjacent to the Temple Mount, the holiest site. And Israel, of course, claims ownership of the site. It's part of Jerusalem, but it's in East Jerusalem. And the American policy for many years now, for decades, has been that East Jerusalem, in fact, all of Jerusalem, is still up for negotiation. And so this visit is trying to do two things at once, the visit to the Western Wall. On the one hand, pay respect to the holiest Jewish site of prayer, and on the other hand, not anger Arab partners and the Palestinians by bringing an Israeli official, Netanyahu himself probably, to the site and therefore endorsing in the image Israeli ownership over the site. And this is just indicative of how sensitive each little piece of rock is in Jerusalem.
You almost sound like you're a fatalist about this. Is there any way any kind of peace can come into existence in this area of the world?
Yes, absolutely. I don't think I'm a fatalist on this. I think, though, we have to be extremely realistic. I think peace is possible, but it needs to be small peace. We need to think of it in realistic terms. And a peace deal, perhaps, between the parties, a full peace deal, is also perhaps possible. I don't think it's possible at the moment. I hope I'm wrong, and I may be wrong, and I wish the negotiators all success. But I think even if we can't reach that full peace agreement now, I think perhaps we can in the future, there are a lot of things we can do now to lay the groundwork for peace in the future. These economic steps that I mentioned, stopping erosion of the possibility of a two-state solution, all these things can be done now. And in fact, they're more important because prospects for peace are difficult, not less important. So although things look grim in terms of final status agreement soon, I think that actually puts the onus on all of us, and especially the parties themselves, to think about how to advance the possibility of keeping the two-state solution open for the future. We should be very realistic about the difficulties. The Middle East is not an easy region, but fatalism is simply not an option by duty, but also realistically. Things change. They can change for the worse, and they often can change for the better as well.
Well, we shall see what happens. Natan Sachs is director and a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much for lending your expertise. We greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Another big story we're covering for you that's broken in the past few hours. U.S. media reports are saying that former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn will invoke his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination and declined to cooperate with a Senate subpoena to hand over documents related to the probe into Russia's meddling in the U.S. election. The Senate Intelligence Committee is seeking the documents as part of its investigation. Flynn had previously sought immunity. The Senate committee probe is one of several ongoing inquiries into possible Trump campaign collusion with Moscow interests to help him win the election. Well, I'm sure those first two stories are trending on social media. Andrew Palshevsky is with us, and he's been following it all day. Is it of interest to people online?
You are absolutely correct. It is trending, both of these stories trending on social media. As Mr. Sachs just mentioned, Donald Trump, the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Western Wall, a fact that's being shared across social media. And we're seeing a lot of the photos and video from that visit going through social media. But we're also seeing a flip side of that, a lot of people talking about Donald Trump's remarks about the comments or the information that he may have given to the Russian foreign minister and Russian ambassador back when he met with them in Washington. He said today that he didn't mention Israel to the Russians. Many people on social media saying that that shows that Israel was the source of classified information that he may have revealed and kind of playing his hand there. Even before he arrived in Israel, we saw a lot, kind of a mixed bag in Saudi Arabia, the previous stop on this trip, where President Trump signed the defense deal, a multi-million dollar, $100 million defense deal with the Saudis, gave a speech on Islamist terrorism and extremism. But many people pointing out, going back into the social media archives, finding posts from Donald Trump where he said that Saudi Arabia wanted to imprison women and wanted to kill gays, and really calling out the country, even video clips where he said that they were responsible for the September 11th attacks.
It's a continuation of the comparison of what he said during the campaign and what he is learning, which is probably understandable because you know more things when you're president than you do when you're a candidate.
And that's what the White House says. It's part of the evolution as you become president that you change and your positions change. And this is, to be fair, what other administrations have said in the past. They said that there's an evolution that goes on. But the other big story is that Michael Flynn news, especially as the Trump administration is trying to use this trip to change the narrative, this is probably an unwelcome distraction for them. Again, going back to the archives of social media, people finding tweets from Michael Flynn where he said that Hillary Clinton's staff who took the Fifth are guilty because taking the Fifth means that you're guilty. A lot of people pulling that up. One tweet I saw said, said, hypocrisy does not prohibit you from taking the Fifth Amendment, invoking your Fifth Amendment rights, as Michael Flynn will plan to do. So not a welcome distraction for the Trump administration, and not, I'm sure, welcome for Michael Flynn that his tweets are all there in the archive, that people can go pull them up and see what he said in about the Fifth Amendment in the past.
You know, it's always been the case, or since the human writing, that what you say in the past can come back to bite you, you know, in wherever. But now, with social media and digitization of the world, it's much easier to do that.
And nothing ever goes away. It can always be found somewhere on the internet. So people may say things, delete them, think they've done away with them, but then they have their way of coming back up and sometimes coming to bite them.
Like Andrew 2 weeks. No, I won't get into that. Andrew Palaszczuk.
I only say good things on social media.
Right. Yeah, but you don't even have to be. No, we won't get into that. This is International Edition on VOA. Among the top stories in the world, U.S. President Donald Trump assailed Iranian aggression and military ambitions as he arrived in Israel. Reports say former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn will invoke his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination and decline to cooperate with a Senate subpoena to hand over documents related to the probe into Russia's meddling in the U.S. election. Turkey summons the U.S. ambassador to Ankara to protest what is called the aggressive treatment of Turkish security personnel during last week's visit to Washington by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The UN Security Council holds an emergency meeting in response to North Korea's latest ballistic missile test. Expanded coverage of these and more stories on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. We continue now. North Korea Monday said it successfully tested the solid-fuel intermediate-range Pukugsang-2 ballistic missile Sunday after it reached an altitude of 500 kilometers and a distance of 560 kilometers before falling into the Sea of Japan. It claimed that launch, observed by leader Kim Jong-un, confirmed its combat readiness and it will be deployed.
한미 정보 당국은 북한이 어제 미사일 발사를 통해서
미사일 The South Korean Joint Chiefs of Staff spokesman Ro Jae-chian said South Korean and U.S. intelligence authorities believe Pyongyang did secure meaningful data in enhancing the credibility of its missile technology, but further verification is needed to determine whether it's mastered the reentry technology for missile warheads. Still, the South Korean Unification Ministry said while a strong response to the North's launch is expected, Seoul will not cut off civilian inter-Korean exchanges, saying it will not foster stability in the Korean Peninsula. In Riyadh, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson told Fox News Sunday that the U.S. is still in the early stages of applying economic and diplomatic pressure on North Korea.
Hopefully, they will get the message that the pathway of continuing their nuclear arms program is not a pathway to security or certainly prosperity. The ongoing testing is disappointing, it's disturbing, and we ask that they cease that because until they cease that testing, clearly they have not changed their view. But I think we're early into the game of putting pressure on them, and one could also interpret that perhaps they're just acting out now in response to some of this pressure that I believe they're beginning to feel.
Japan Monday vowed to pursue its own sanctions against North Korea, while the UN Security Council is expected to take up that matter today. RAND Corporation defense analyst Bruce Bennett told VOA's Victor Beatty Sunday's launch came a week after the North fired off another intermediate-range missile, both aimed at developing an intercontinental ballistic missile.
It appears that the missile tested last weekend was the first stage of the ICBM. The one tested this weekend may well be the second stage. It could be a mixed liquid-fuel-solid fuel combination. So I think they're trying to make progress towards accomplishing the ICBM, as Kim Jong-un said in his New Year's address. And that's worrisome because they do seem to be making progress.
On Monday, North Korea said it had successfully tested an intermediate-range ballistic missile to confirm the reliability of a late-stage guidance of the nuclear warhead. What does that mean?
They're looking to try and develop not only a missile that can deliver a warhead, but deliver it relatively accurately. From what I've heard from some former senior defectors, they apparently have been using some form of GPS, potentially U.S. and Russian and maybe Chinese, in their programs. But to make that work, they've got to put together a system that exploits both the location information and guidance. They're at least claiming that they're getting there. We don't know for sure that that's the case.
Well, Bruce, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on the political fallout said economic and diplomatic pressure will continue on the North. Quote, the ongoing testing is disappointing, disturbing, and we ask that it cease. The Foreign Ministry Office in South Korea said the tests were, quote, reckless and irresponsible, throwing cold water over hopes and desires of the new government of Moon Jae-in and the International Committee for Denuclearization and Peace on the Korean Peninsula. Is the peace effort over before it even begins as far as South Korea is concerned?
No, I think President Moon Jae-in wants to get back to it, but Kim Jong-un has got to let him. Moon Jae-in, with the South Korean populace, the broader populace that he now serves as president, has to be responsive to bad actions by North Korea. And these continuing missile launches constrain him in his ability to reconcile with the North. The North's got to cut it out, or he's not going to be able to make the progress he would like to.
Bruce Bennett said the fear is that the North could someday test launch a missile with a nuclear warhead, and the U.S. may be preparing to deploy warships in the Sea of Japan to intercept it. Stay tuned to The Voice of America for all of the latest information on that and other stories. This is VOA.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Do you love music from Africa and the world? VOA has the latest hits, interviews with the artists, and we are glad to take your requests. The Voice of America has what you're looking for. We have music shows to please everyone. Join us on the radio or on the internet to listen day or night. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on your favorite program. Just follow your ears. Music from Africa and the world. We've got it on VOA.
This is VOA's International Edition. Oscar winners Dustin Hoffman and Emma Thompson and comedians Ben Stiller and Adam Sandler star in a new comedy from director Noah Baumbach. It's called The Meyerowitz Stories. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the story looks at the relationships between adult men and their fathers and is competing for the top award at the Cannes Film Festival.
Adam Sandler is earning high praise for his dramatic turn as Danny Meyerowitz in The Meyerowitz Stories. Sandler plays a stay-at-home dad who never quite had the success his demanding father Harold, a mediocre sculptor played by Dustin Hoffman, expected. Danny's marriage is ending, his daughter is leaving home for college, and he lives in the shadow of his successful half-brother Matthew, played by Ben Stiller. Matthew lives in Los Angeles and constantly refers to Danny and his sister Jean, portrayed by Elizabeth Marvel, as his half-brother and sister to emphasize their separation. But the siblings are thrown together when their father is hospitalized with a brain hemorrhage. The siblings argue over whether to sell Harold's Manhattan apartment, work together to stage a retrospective of his work at Bard College, where he was once on the faculty, and try to come to some sense of reconciliation. The film premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, where director Noah Baumbach said the comedic drama gave him a chance to explore ideas he had for years.
In various ways, in my movies, I'm interested in sort of the gap between who we think we are and or who we want to be and who we are, and how far that gap is. And obviously success and professional success and fame and and the arts is a kind of way to explore that.
Dustin Hoffman said that Baumbach has a way of bringing out the best performances from his cast, both through his comedic timing and his dramatic sensitivity.
He's quite expert. He really is the best. And we do say his dialogue word for word, whether we like it or not. And I think not since The Graduate was I required to say every single word. And it pays off because there is a music to his writing. I agree with Ben. He is a singular artist.
British Oscar winner Emma Thompson stars as Hoffman's third wife, Maureen, an alcoholic who wears tie-dyes and peace beads. Thompson said she had no real emotional frame of reference playing someone embroiled in such a dysfunctional family.
I read it and thought, I have absolutely no idea what this is going to be like. I know it's going to be fascinating, but I had no idea at all. And then I thought, oh, I'm going to play an American, which is quite hard, and I've got to play an alcoholic, which isn't hard at all. So that was the thing probably that attracted me most, because I thought, well, I'll be able to relax about playing the American, because being drunk will make it so much easier.
Adam Sandler has earned many positive reviews for his portrayal of Danny, proof that he can deliver a strong dramatic performance when he is asked to. Sandler said that he wanted to give his best because of the caliber of people he was working with.
It's different for a comedian when you get an offer like this. And my first thought is I don't want to let anybody down. And I work as hard as I can to make sure I know the material and just try to be as good as I can be.
The Meyerowitz Stories is one of two Netflix entries at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Beginning next year, all films will have to have been released in French cinemas if they want to be considered for the Golden Palm. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You have been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our thanks to director Sarah Williams. For our engineer, Dan Crafton, I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. State Department recently released newly declassified reporting and photos that underscore the brutality of the Syrian regime, made possible by the continuing support of its allies, Russia and Iran. According to the United Nations and credible human rights organizations, the Syrian civil war, which started in 2011, has claimed more than 400,000 lives, many of which were civilians. Since 2012, the regime has routinely conducted airstrikes and artillery strikes in dense urban centers, including with barrel bombs and improvised unguided bombs. The Assad regime systematically targeted eastern Aleppo's hospitals in multiple strikes, killing patients and medical professionals. In addition to airstrikes, the regime continues to systematically abduct and torture civilian detainees, often beating, electrocuting, and raping these victims. According to numerous NGOs, the regime has abducted and detained between 65,000 and 117,000 people between 2011 and 2016. Moreover, the regime has also authorized the extrajudicial killings of thousands of detainees using mass hangings at the Saydnaya military prison, one of many detention facilities. We now believe that the Syrian regime has installed a crematorium in the Saydnaya prison complex, which could dispose of detainees' remains with little evidence, said Acting Assistant Secretary for Near Eastern Affairs Stuart Jones in a briefing. These appalling atrocities have been carried out seemingly with the unconditional support from Russia and Iran, said Acting Assistant Secretary Jones. 2 weeks ago, at the Astana conference in Kazakhstan, Turkey, Russia, and Iran, the guarantors of the Astana process, agreed to create de-escalation zones that would reduce violence and save lives. In light of the failures of past ceasefire agreements, the United States has reason to be skeptical about this agreement. The regime must stop all attacks on civilians and opposition forces, and Russia must bear responsibility to ensure regime compliance, said Acting Assistant Secretary Jones. Russia has either aided in or passively looked on as the regime has conducted an airstrike against a UN convoy, destroyed East Aleppo, and used chemical weapons, including sarin, against civilians in Idlib province on April 4th. During his recent visit, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov acknowledged that there is no military solution to the Syrian conflict. Russia must now, with great urgency, exercise its influence over the Syrian regime to guarantee that horrific violations stop now.